From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, guns. We talk with journalist Eric Larson about what he calls a de facto conspiracy of gun dealers, manufacturers, and federal regulators. A conspiracy which makes it easy to get guns and assures their use in bedrooms, alleys, and schoolyards. Also, how the brain remembers. We talk with a pioneer in brain and memory research, Dr. Daniel Alcon. And book critic John Leonard reviews Edward Hoagland's new book of essays, Balancing Acts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali met with the leaders of 14 rival Somali clans in Addis Ababa today in an effort to bring peace to Somalia. Meanwhile, a student protest against the UN leader in the Ethiopian capital ended in death. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
The demonstrators who gathered on Addis Ababa's university campus apparently had nothing against Boutros Ghali's efforts in Somalia. They were upset because the United Nations is involved in a controversial issue in their own country. Ethiopia's northern province of Eritrea has been struggling for decades to become independent. And in April, the United Nations will sponsor a referendum in Eritrea so its citizens can decide whether to form a brand new country. Many Ethiopians oppose the referendum. And today, the students lashed out at Boutros Ghali for supporting it. Details about the incident are sketchy, but police opened fire on the apparently unarmed crowd, killing at least one demonstrator, according to government sources, and possibly as many as seven, according to students. Scores of protesters were injured. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Addis Ababa.
The Yugoslav peace talks in Geneva were abruptly recessed today while Serbian leaders consult on a compromise peace plan for Bosnia. The UN mediator, Cyrus Vance, said talks are scheduled to resume on Monday among leaders of the Bosnian Muslims, Croats, and Serbs. Vance and the EC mediator, Lord Owen, have proposed a plan under which Bosnia would be divided into semi-autonomous provinces based partly on ethnic divisions. The Serbs have demanded a Serbian republic in Bosnia. The START II nuclear missile reduction treaty doesn't end the arms race, but U.S. and Soviet negotiators apparently will be taking a break. No major negotiations are scheduled, and prospects for an early meeting between Russian President Boris Yeltsin and President-elect Bill Clinton are dim. Barry Schweid has details.
The missile reduction treaty makes the most sweeping cuts yet in deadly nuclear weapons, but the arms race isn't over by a long shot, and there are no signs that the U.S. and Russia plan to initiate another round of deep cuts anytime soon. The new Clinton administration has its eye mostly on domestic problems. In fact, the president-elect is diplomatically turning down Russian President Boris Yeltsin's suggestion that they meet at a neutral site soon. Yeltsin can't move too quickly either to cut nuclear weapons further. The START II treaty has its critics in the Supreme Soviet, and there also is some anxiety about the slow way Ukraine is dealing with its obligation to get rid of its nuclear weapons. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 3,309. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. There was more fighting reported today in Angola, where rebels and government troops accused one another of starting the clashes that left as many as 200 people dead. UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali said government troops threatened to shoot UN peacekeepers when they tried to intervene. The two sides in Angola have agreed to UN-sponsored talks to avoid a resumption of the country's 16-year civil war, but the UN mandate expires at the end of this month. Convicted junk bond dealer Michael Milken was transferred yesterday from a federal work camp to a Los Angeles area halfway house. The move comes 22 months into Milken's 2-year sentence for securities fraud. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Michael Milken will be allowed to leave the halfway house between the hours of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. in order to perform community service. His sentence requires that he perform 1,800 hours of community service each year for the next 3 years. What form that service will take is unknown. A spokeswoman for Milken said he will put together a work plan with the court. Milken also paid $1.1 billion in federal fines and $1.3 billion in civil settlements. He earned as much as $550 million a year during the 1980s when his junk bond deals helped fuel corporate takeovers and leveraged buyouts. Originally, Milken was sentenced to 10 years in prison, but his sentence was reduced in exchange for his cooperation in other government investigations into securities fraud. He will complete his sentence and leave the halfway house on March 2nd. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The first ship carrying plutonium from France to Japan reportedly completed its voyage today. Japanese television says that the specially outfitted freighter, loaded with 1.7 tons of plutonium, has docked at a port about 70 miles from Tokyo. The voyage stirred protests from environmental and anti-nuclear activists. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Guns are becoming frighteningly common in America. So is murder. Over the past 2 years, guns have killed 60,000 Americans, more than the number of American soldiers killed in the Vietnam War. My guest Eric Larson is writing a book about the domestic gun trade. His article, The Story of a Gun, is the cover story of the Atlantic magazine's January issue. It traces how a 16-year-old bought a semi-automatic handgun at a Virginia store, hid it in his backpack with hundreds of rounds of ammunition, and took it to the Atlantic Shores Christian School in Virginia Beach, where he fired 15 rounds, killing one teacher and wounding another. Larson says this story illustrates the de facto conspiracy of gun dealers, manufacturers, marketers, and federal regulators, a conspiracy which makes guns too easy to come by. Larson told me about the gun the underage youth of his story managed to buy.
The specific gun is called a Cobra M11-9, and it is a semi-automatic version of a legendary, perhaps I should say notorious, submachine gun created in the 60s, specifically for use by guerrilla forces and commando forces. The initial weapon, and this is part of the reason that I found this such an astonishing story, was that, you know, here was a gun devised specifically to kill as many people as possible in as short an amount of time, that for various reasons never really was a big hit with police departments or the military. And yet it attained this incredible reputation and became, in fact, the weapon of choice among drug dealers and gangs throughout the late 70s and early 80s. Not just that gun, but other variations of it made by subsequent owners of the company.
You fired it on a target range. What did it feel like?
This is where the whole gun issue really gets kind of clarified for me. And this may sound strange. Shooting that gun on the gun range, I got to say, was a blast. No apologies. Shooting a gun, and I've subsequently learned to shoot a handgun, is fun. I mean, it's this strange experience where you stand there and you blast away with this semi-automatic weapon that at one time was designed to kill as many people as possible, and you just fire at these targets and the dirt flies and so forth, and it's somehow it's very removed from the streets. It's just fun. It's kind of exciting. It's this big adrenaline rush.
Well, the person who bought the gun and murdered the teacher was underage. How did he get a semi-automatic gun?
He got that gun through the means that is really the primary means by which guns are diverted from the legitimate distribution channel, so-called legitimate distribution channels, to illegal users, to the bad guys, to the kids who use them in the cities. And that is a so-called straw man purchase. That's where a qualified buyer, a buyer who is qualified by federal or local regulations to buy that gun, acquires it and then gives it or sells it to an unqualified buyer. In this case, a kid. I mean, he was, I believe, if I'm recalling this correctly, 15 at the time he actually acquired the weapon.
So there was someone who bought it for him in the store. But
right.
But the way you describe it, it sounded like the actual firearms dealer probably saw what was happening.
Well, yeah, and here, I necessarily have to be a little discreet because you have to look at the court record very carefully, and you have to to understand the nature of the transaction in considerable detail to reach that conclusion. However, I should say also that a jury did reach that conclusion in a liability suit, in a civil liability suit, awarded $100,000 to the family of the dead teacher. The nature of that transaction was very suspicious. Here was a guy who goes into the gun store with a child, and this child is doing all the shopping, is asking some very knowledgeable, detailed questions about guns, and is clearly the guiding shopper in this transaction. And nonetheless, the dealer sold the gun to the older cousin.
You say a none of my business attitude prevails in the gun industry. What do you mean by that?
Well, by that I mean that you know, companies, gun makers, gun dealers, they can very actively promote and market guns as being deadly weapons, as being ideal for self-defense. Companies can specifically design their weapons to be as lethal as possible. Ammunition makers will put full-page ads in gun magazines talking about wound channels and the kind of devastation that their particular bullet can wreak on the human body. And yet, when someone then uses their wares to kill somebody, it's like, hey, it's not my responsibility. It's not my problem. It's guns don't kill, you know, people do.
Do you think it should be the responsibility or the problem of the gun industry?
It's too simple to say that it's not my problem. Again, you have to get fairly specific about it. When you look, for example, I examined a series of transactions made by this particular gun dealer in this case. And what I found is that, you know, in Virginia, all this gun dealer is required by federal law to do, to sell a gun to a kid, to an ostensibly qualified buyer, is have that buyer fill out something called a Form 4473, which is a form that simply indicates that this guy bought a handgun, and it asks eight questions. You know, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Have you ever been judged mentally incompetent? Have you ever given up your U.S. citizenship? That kind of thing. But the problem is that this form is ideal for discharging responsibility. There is no effort on anybody's part to follow up on what is asked on that form. When that buyer fills it out, he's responsible for saying yes or no, and knows damn well that if he says yes to any of those questions, he's not going to get that gun. So what's he going to do? He's going to say no. And he's going to sign it, and that's the end of it. As far as the gun dealer is concerned, that's all he's got to do. As far as the federal regulators are concerned, that's all he's got to do. And I just think that that's not enough.
You applied to buy a gun last May. What was the process like for you?
Actually, I did not apply to buy a gun. I did something that I consider actually more significant in terms of what we see and read about every day. I became a licensed federal arms dealer. That is to say that I got my federal firearms license. I mean, I'm not selling guns, nor do I intend to. But I did that because I wanted to find out how easy it was to get that kind of a license. And I found out that it was incredibly easy. It was the easiest, far easier than getting my driver's license, believe me. I just paid my $30, filled out the form, and within 45 days, theoretically, I could have been in business.
What were you asked on the form?
Well, you know, the same questions. Was I ever convicted of this, that, and the other thing? Was I judged mentally incompetent? Other questions on the form were, you know, would my dealership be open to the public? And my answer was yes. If I open my dealership, it will be open to the public. Was it available for inspection by federal agents? And my answer was yes. Federal agents are welcome. Another requirement was that I would place the license in full public view in my place of business, and in fact in my office it is taped to the wall in full public view. Apart from that, there's really nothing that is else specified.
So the point you're making is that anybody could sell guns, basically.
Well, yeah, and furthermore, people do that. There are something like 236,000 federal firearms licensees, of whom, according to one interview I had at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, probably about half don't actually operate storefronts, which means that there's an awful lot of me's out there who are empowered, depending on state and local regulations that might add certain rules, who are empowered to buy guns from distributors and sell them out of their homes.
Meanwhile, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which regulates the industry, you say they're very understaffed, that there are 400 inspectors for 425,000 licensed firearms dealers.
Yeah. Well, they are, first of all, I believe it's 400 inspectors for 236,000 or whatever it is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They just have that many inspectors, there's just an awful lot of work that needs to be done in terms of inspecting and tracking dealers that the ATF simply cannot do. And interestingly, when they do routine compliance inspections, these people find an awful lot of violations.
You went to gun shows, you read gun magazines, you examined gun culture. What did you find that really surprised you?
Well, one of the things that's most surprising, and I recommend this to anybody who wants kind of a scary kick on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon, is to go visit a gun show.
A
gun show, yeah. I mean, you know you're there right away because, for example, I pulled up at one gun show in Frederick, Maryland, and it's not every day that you see a guy walking up to the door to this agricultural display building carrying an AR-15 slung over his shoulder. You know, it's just a really wild experience. And you go inside, and man, it's the gun culture in full view. There was a guy walking around with a gun slung over his shoulder with a sign stuck in the barrel saying "for sale." You see, private sales are a big thing. Private sales are utterly unregulated by the federal government. You have to fill out the form 4473 when you buy a gun from a dealer. But then, if you turn around and want to sell that to your neighbor, there's no paperwork required whatsoever. So these people come to these gun shows to sell their own weapons, and it's really a riot. One guy had a whole, literally a billboard on his back saying what guns he had to offer, and the ones he'd already sold were crossed off.
Did people approach you about anything?
You mean to buy anything? Or?
Mm-hmm.
No, nobody came up to me and said, hey, you want to buy a gun? But, the commerce was in the air. It was real interesting. I think one of the... one of the kind of most, the scariest, scary, I don't know, it's one of the shocking things was I saw a display, a video display from a company that makes fairly exotic ammunition, things that explode in the body and so forth. And this was a systematic effort to show how powerful their bullets were, working up to their most powerful. And what was on this video was the guy would sit there on his chair behind a table, and he would shoot these bullets into what is called a block of what's called ordnance gelatin, which is a gelatin compound, yellowish gelatin compound, designed specifically to emulate the behavior of human flesh on contact with a bullet, and to show the wound channel and the cavity and so forth. And I was standing there as a father and his son were watching this thing, and the kid couldn't have been more than, I don't know, like 8. And he was just watching it absolutely rapt. And there was his father, too. And it was like this big father and son thing, watching all these bullets destroy emulated human flesh. It was a terrific outing for a Sunday afternoon, you know?
Yeah. You point out that sometimes guns get more popular after films that feature that gun. For instance, the Smith & Wesson became more popular after Dirty Harry.
Right.
What are you seeing now in terms of the influence of movies or TV on guns?
Well, it hasn't subsided. I mean, this has been a constant feature of the gun culture and its relationship to Hollywood since the 70s. I mean, McHugh, a movie starring John Wayne, really virtually put the put this Ingram submachine gun, which is the forerunner of the gun I write about, really put that on the map. It was a I couldn't imagine better advertising for a gun than that particular movie. Miami Vice did the same for the Ingram and for other weapons. I don't want to think about what Lethal Weapon has done for the Beretta, which is what Mel Gibson virtually marries in each film. I think more shocking even than that is that after a major incident involving a homicide, or as is typically the case, a multiple homicide involving a particular firearm, the price of that firearm very often goes up. After the Stockton schoolyard shootings, the price of the weapon used there, and I believe it was an AK-47 or an SKS version, which is a semi-automatic version of it, soared, absolutely soared. Same with the rifle used by Lee Harvey Oswald to assassinate John F. Kennedy. The value of that gun rose incredibly.
What does the price go up?
Demand. I mean, that is the great question, is what is it about America that when a bunch of school kids are mowed down in a Stockton, California schoolyard, that the weapon that did it becomes a hot prospect, a hot commodity? I'm frankly at a loss. I'm disturbed by it, but I can't really explain it.
I guess it becomes like a celebrity gun.
Yeah. You know, very much the same as when the Smith & Wesson Model 29 was used by Dirty Harry. It became a hot thing to have. It makes you feel bad, I guess. You know, it makes you feel like you're powerful, and it's something to bring out over for conversation while the fire is burning bright in your home or something. I don't know.
My guest is Eric Larson. He's writing a book on the gun trade in America. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Eric Larson. His article about guns is in this month's Atlantic Magazine. You're writing a book about guns now.
Yeah.
Are you more cognizant about the possibility of guns than you ever were before? Do you walk down the street looking at people thinking, I wonder which one of these guys has a gun?
I do, actually. I know now, for example, where people tend to carry guns. And
where?
Well, guys, one of the fashions is to carry it in the small of the back, in a belt, in the belt, perhaps in a holster, perhaps not. And so you always look to see how that prints on a jacket. For example, recently my local liquor store has become very aware of security for reasons I'm not quite sure of, but they installed, you know, these big fences and so forth, and now they have a security guy who walks around with he's the only guy in the place with his shirt untucked. And I watched him real closely one day, and I realized this guy's got a gun tucked into the back of his belt. I also look very carefully at women who are wearing so-called fanny packs. That's become the mode of choice for civilians who want to carry a weapon.
Do you own a gun?
No, I don't own a gun. But I have to say, you know, I consider myself, I get really offended when people automatically try to fit me into a category and say, oh, well, because you're the media, you're anti-gun, or someone else perhaps to at some point argue that I'm pro-gun. I think that does a major disservice to most of the Americans out there who have guns and keep them for self-defense and who are truly responsible, safe, concerned owners of those weapons. But when I think about myself owning a gun, I don't know. I think that I might, depending on my circumstances. If I lived way out in a rural area, and if I didn't have two small kids, and there were You know, there was a motorcycle gang that was known to pass by on the road out front. Yeah, maybe. Maybe I would. You never really can tell until you're in that situation, I think. You know, I've been talking a lot to women over the last couple of weeks for something else about why they own guns and why they've taken a shooting course. And it's very compelling to hear these very reasonable, sane women, very concerned, often petrified of guns before they first picked one up, saying that, yes, they now carry a gun, and they appreciate how deadly they are. But they're going to carry it because they don't want to be a victim. So I'm, you know, my views are evolving. I don't know. I don't know. I cannot say that at some point I would not buy a gun. Mm-hmm. I like to think that I won't be driven to that point and that I never will. The one thing I can say with certainty is that with two small kids, I will not own a gun.
Do you think in the gun literature there's the assumption or the knowledge that some of the people who are reading this are killers?
I don't see how anybody who is in the business, and again, this cuts to this matter of responsibility versus irresponsibility. I don't see how anybody in the business can not know and fully expect that some of the readers and buyers are killers, psychos, rapists, and otherwise. I mean, it kind of goes with the territory. Look, you know, we're talking about an industry that just in day-to-day operation has to take some very bizarre operating steps to stay in business. You walk into a gun store, like this gun store down in Virginia, first thing you notice is the tank traps in the sidewalk out front, which were put there because somebody a couple years ago had driven a dump truck through the display windows in order to get at the guns. Second thing you notice is that the doorway's been reinforced, that there's a herringbone steel grate across the windows, and that there's a gigantic Pepsi machine placed deliberately right next to the lock side of the door so that nobody can get through all those other defenses and reach behind and open the door. Most striking is the clerks at the counter, who are both wearing large bore revolvers or high caliber pistols. I mean, this is an industry that just to operate on a daily basis takes precautions that probably the Secret Service doesn't even take, at least not as visibly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Eric Larson's article, The Story of a Gun, is in this month's Atlantic Magazine. Larson joined us last month to discuss his book about direct mail marketing called The Naked Consumer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Memory. Sometimes I think I'm losing mine. Coming up, we talk about memory and forgetting with a pioneer in memory research, Dr. Daniel Alcon. He's the chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Balancing Acts, the new book of essays by Edward Hoagland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Leaders of the various warring sides in Bosnia broke off their peace talks in Geneva today, one day earlier than they had planned. The co-chairman of the International Conference in Yugoslavia, Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen, presented the three sides with what they said was the final version of their peace plan. Peace talks are set to resume next week. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Geneva.
Vance and Owen say their final plan is not quite a take-it-or-leave-it proposition, but almost. There's not a lot of scope for change, Lord Owen said. The plan has three elements. First, a division of Bosnia into 10 self-governing provinces. Second, a new constitution that binds the provinces inextricably together and guarantees the protection of minority rights. Third, a detailed formula for stopping the fighting in Bosnia and demilitarizing the country. The Bosnian Croat side has accepted all three elements. The Bosnian government delegation is reportedly prepared to accept the constitution and the ceasefire plan, though it is not happy with the way the 10 provinces have been laid out. The Bosnian Serb delegation, meanwhile, appears to be most unhappy. The Serbs would have to give up their dream of establishing a separate state on Bosnian territory, and that won't be easy. I'm Tom Gelton in Geneva.
More than two dozen protesters demonstrated outside the U.S. Senate today, demanding that Oregon Senator Bob Packwood not be seated when a new Congress is sworn in tomorrow. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The protest was sponsored by the National Organization for Women, which, like other women's groups, is angry at Packwood for allegedly making numerous unwanted sexual advances toward female aides. The Oregon Republican narrowly won re-election in November, shortly before press reports of the incidents began appearing. The president of NOW, Patricia Ireland, says it's probably unrealistic to keep Packwood from being seated tomorrow, but she says her group wants to keep pressure on him to resign.
We'll see what happens with it, but we want to make sure that they don't think that this is going to be swept aside easily.
Packwood has already apologized for the incidents, saying they may have been related to his own alcohol abuse. But there was more bad news for him over the weekend when the Portland Oregonian reported that some of his staff members were improperly ordered to engage in fundraising on Senate time. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
President-elect Bill Clinton spoke by telephone this morning with Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Clinton said that he would do all he can to get early ratification of the newly signed START II treaty. Clinton also said that he would like to meet with Yeltsin, but that probably will not take place until he and Congress get started on domestic problems. A Clinton spokesman said the two leaders had a very good 20-minute phone conversation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 8 points to close at 3,309.22 on volume of nearly 200 million shares. This is NPR News. In Poland, most of some 300,000 striking coal miners are back on the job after a walkout lasting 3 weeks. Strike leaders said that work resumed at 60 state mines out of 65 affected by the protest. Under a new agreement, indebted mines will get government aid, and officials will try to get credits from international groups to make changes in the coal industry. Despite last-minute legal efforts by death penalty opponents, the state of Washington is scheduled to execute Wesley Allen Dodd early tomorrow morning. He received the death sentence 2 years ago for killing three children. It will be the first execution in Washington in 30 years and the nation's first hanging since 1965. Michael Marcotte of member station KPLU reports.
The 31-year-old Dodd wants to hang. He pled guilty to the kidnappings, rapes, and murders of three boys and waived his right to appeal the jury's death sentence. The Washington Supreme Court today rejected a plea by religious groups who said hanging is cruel and unusual punishment violating Dodd's constitutional rights. Also today, the State Clemency Board refused a petition from church groups to stop the execution. At that hearing, one of the prosecutors in the case, Art Curtis, called Dodd's crimes horrific.
If there ever was a case for the need for a death penalty in a civilized society, I suggest that Wesley Allen Dodd is a prime example.
Washington Governor Booth Gardner says he plans to let the hanging proceed as scheduled, 1 minute past midnight tonight in the state penitentiary at Walla Walla. For National Public Radio, I'm Michael Marcotte in Olympia, Washington.
According to the World Bank, average income in Switzerland is the highest in the world at more than $36,000 a year. Average income in the U.S. is put at more than $33,000, putting it in 10th place. According to the World Bank, the poorest nations in the world are in Africa. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
There. I wish I could control my memory. I wish I could remember all the new things I learned, that I would never again embarrass myself by forgetting the name of the person I just met. I wish I could forget some of the more miserable things that have happened to me. I know very little about how memory works, so I was interested in what Dr. Daniel Alcon is learning about it. Dr. Alcon is a pioneer in the field of memory and learning. He's chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health and a medical director of the United States Public Health Service. He's written a new book about his research called Memory's Voice, Deciphering the Mind-Brain Code. He's investigating how learning and memories leave an imprint on the brain. He began his research studying the neural networks of snails.
While I was a medical student, I kind of hatched these ideas as to how brain circuits would learn, and I decided that the only way I could test these ideas was by finding first a very simple wiring, such as might occur in a snail, and essentially what I looked for was what I called in my book evolution's compromise, a compromise between having a nervous system that was complex enough to learn memory such as relevant to our own experience, humans, but simple enough that we might be able to tease it apart in intricate detail. And the reason why that's so essential is that you have to think of the billions and billions of neurons in the human brain, and the billions of wires, even almost infinite number of wires between these neurons, to realize how impossible and difficult it is to tease apart the actual paths of electrical signals in the human brain. We're starting to, and we can talk a little bit about that later. But in a snail, where you have only some thousands of neurons, we could use today's technology for essentially listening to these signals and trace the signals as they were actually learning a memory. And once we traced them, we could find the chemical changes that were actually storing the memory. Just as, for example, when we record a voice on a tape recorder, there are certain physical and chemical changes on that tape to store that voice. There are physical and chemical changes in the snail's brain, in a rabbit's brain, and in the human brain to store that memory.
Well, snails don't have memories of summer vacations and youthful romance. What kind of memory did you teach it so you could try to find how the memory was being stored?
Well, we began with a very simple associative memory, one described by Pavlov at the turn of the century. Pavlovian conditioning involves a dog, for example, learning to link the smell of meat with a sound of a bell that just occurs before it. In a way, the dog's salivation, every time it hears the sound, is like a measurable demonstration that inside the dog's brain, a link has actually been formed to record, to make that tape recording of an association. So what we wanted to do is to find an association like Pavlov found with a dog in the snail. And once we found that association, we could look in much more complex associations, let's say in rabbits and hopefully in mammals as well, higher mammals and even humans, to see if the principles were the same.
So what were you able to actually see in the snail's brain? Do snails have brains? Am I using the right word?
Yes, it's fair.
Uh-huh. So were you actually able to watch the memory being stored?
Yes. Ultimately, we were able to watch it. And really, this was the first time that in the history of biology that it was possible to watch an association being formed as it was formed in a living brain system.
What did it look like?
Well, first, if you wanted to know what it looks like in the laboratory, you're looking at a screen, like a TV screen, only the screen is largely dark except a kind of very, very bright fluorescent trace, which kind of is constantly moving up and down in a certain pattern. So the first form of that memory is a pattern of signals on a fluorescent screen, which is changing as the snail learns to link, to associate a flash of light with being shaken about as if it were in the sea. It's a sea snail. And so you first see these fluorescent trace patterns changing. And then if you look in a little bit more detail at those neurons, you can start seeing that the flow of charged particles across the cells inside that brain are also changing. And then if you look even in a little more detail, which is even the most exciting level, you start to see the chemicals, the actual chemicals that are changing to allow this phosphorescent trace to give us these signal patterns.
So you were monitoring the brain on like a video screen?
Well, you can video record those. That's right. It's like a video screen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And just to explain here, the Pavlovian type behavior you taught the snail was you'd show it a flash of light, and then shake up the tube that it lived in. So the snail learned to associate that after it saw the light, it was going to get this rude shaking.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Daniel Alcon. He's the chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health. And he's also the author of a new book about memory called Memory's Voice. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Daniel Alcon is my guest, author of a new book about research into memory called Memory's Voice. Now, what's the relevance of what you saw in the snail to the human brain?
Well, humans, first of all, can be Pavlovian conditioning, too. And in fact, most interesting to me is that some of the nature of traumatic conditioning involves emotional responses to certain stimuli. Some people, for example, who have suffered wartime stress may be all right for a while, and they suddenly see a certain situation, a town marketplace, which, let's say, they were bombed in or they were wounded in, and suddenly the entire experience from war flashes back. It's as if the situation in the marketplace was linked to that wartime experience.
Is there any kind of chemical or neurological comparison you can make between the snail and the human brain?
Well, that's what we're beginning to find encouragement for, that that the nature of these linkages is such that they involve chemicals not only in the snail but in mammals and humans that are virtually the same or very much very similar. And when, for example, an addict, even when he or she is detoxified and the metabolic dependence is lost, sometimes you just show the paraphernalia to that individual, and there's the conditioning. The individual responds with the responses if the addictive substance were introduced or about to be introduced. It's the paraphernalia, that just the image of that paraphernalia. Now, that brings on this condition, response, and expectation. And this is another example of linkage. The hope is that we will understand the chemicals involved in these linkages so well that not only will we be able to offer clinical help to such people, but ultimately we'll be able to image memories as they are being formed in a human brain. And we're beginning to do this with something called PET scanning and magnetic resonance imaging, various techniques which are going to explode in the next 20 years or so, which involve marking those chemicals, those same chemicals that we find are involved in memory storage. We can mark them, make tags for them, and then you can see an image of change throughout a brain structure as the memory is being laid down. And ultimately, you can imagine in the future that we might be able to actually watch memory in the human brain as someone is learning something.
You know, whenever I hear about remarkable possibilities like this, I always say to myself, well, would that be good or bad? Do we really want that? I mean, do we really want to be able to manipulate our memories?
It's a wonderful question, and it's an important question which doesn't have an easy answer. Obviously, there are some wonderful clinical possibilities that can emerge from these kinds of studies and with our new insights, as well as dangers. This kind of knowledge can be abused. When we understood nuclear energy, we unleashed nuclear war and the possibility of nuclear war. So one has to proceed, I think, with a certain amount of faith that more knowledge is better. I can't help but remember Margaret Mead's statement about this some years ago, where she said, I proceed with the faith that knowing more is better for humanity, not worse. But it's more in the realm of faith. And insights on the cellular level, for example, about memory to combat mental disease, whether it's from child abuse or whether it's involved in depression or schizophrenia, however these insights lead us to new answers, don't solve the sociologic problems. They don't solve the legal problems. Just because you may come up with a conclusion that an abuse of a child is going to have profound impact, devastating impact on his or her life later on, doesn't allow you to go into the neighbor's house and say, stop doing that. It doesn't solve that problem. We still are plagued with an enormous number of situations where we know abuse is going on. We know that abusers tend to have more abusers as children. We know that it's bad, even without knowing all the cellular aspects, yet we don't have any answers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Alcon. He's the chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. Memory is of special interest to me because I'm always sure I'm losing mine. Why is it your subject?
Well, my interest in memory began really in my late adolescence when I became concerned and involved with a childhood friend, Michelle, as I call her in the book, who was suffering for some period of years from circumstances in her family that involved child abuse. And even back then, I came to a kind of conclusion or strong hypothesis that these experiences were going to have a profound effect on the rest of her life, and that this effect would be mediated by, depend on, the memories that were being formed, that were being laid down with these dreadful experiences.
Well, your friend Michelle ended up killing herself, so the memories not only haunted her, that you could say that they destroyed her. Generalize out of that about your interest in memory and why certain memories stick with us and others don't, and how memories make us who we are.
Well, of course, even in Michelle's case, whose story is a kind of a subtext for my book, the memories interacted with all of the other factors in her life, her genetic composition, her talents, her attributes. And it was the interaction not only of the memories with what she inherited, but it involved the interaction of Michelle with other people. And what fascinated me was that it's the relationships among people and the memories that we form about these relationships, some of which can be traumatic, whether it's due to physical sexual abuse or rape or post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's these memories which have later a profound impact on the rest of our lives, on the kinds of behavioral patterns that we follow.
You tell in your book how you lost consciousness during a gastric hemorrhage that you had. And I wonder what you remember about the experience and what you think you've been saved from remembering.
Well, most of all, I remembered that aside from the kind of review of my entire life, which rushed through my mind.
That really happened, huh?
It really happened. And there's no doubt in my mind that this is what happens to many people. It's a kind of a review of your life. Aside from that, there was an emotional experience which I have found to some extent almost a guide for the rest of the years that I have followed. And that is that as I was losing consciousness, as my life rushed before me, I felt the sense of relief and release from obligation. It was as if I knew that I could do nothing else. And this release was marvelously pleasant. And it gave me a kind of perspective that it's useful to return to in my everyday life, that it's useful sometimes, although you try very hard at certain times, to let yourself off the hook, to enjoy that release and recognize that sometimes choices won't work and it's time to just let it happen.
Why do you think your life flashes before you when you're threatened with losing your life?
I don't, of course, know, but I can suggest that it's the impending loss of all that you've experienced. It's the sense that you're going to lose it. For example, I remember thinking first of all, of my children and my wife, people most immediately important to me. I remember the flash before me because these were what I was going to lose. And then I had this review of many other things in my life that I was going to lose. I think it's as if you are reviewing all of what you're about to lose. It's anticipating what you're about to lose. And that is the way memories actually serve us. They allow us to anticipate our future. And most of the time, it serves us well. And sometimes we have to work on them because it's keeping us trapped in the past.
Dr. Alcon, I thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Dr. Daniel Alcon is chief of the Neural Systems Laboratory at the National Institutes of Health and author of the new book, Memory's Voice. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, there are meetings in two cities to try to take care of problems which are vexing the world. There's a meeting in Addis Ababa about the future of Somalia. And then there's a meeting in Geneva about the future of Yugoslavia, and we will have reports on both those meetings. We also have a feature on Angel Island, which is a kind of West Coast version of Ellis Island. It's the place where the great Asian immigration passed through. President-elect Clinton talked today to Boris Yeltsin, and they're already talking about a summit. And then we'll have the great jazz bass player Ron Carter's new recording of Bach on bass.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Edward Hoagland is the author of 5 novels and 2 volumes of travel writing, but he's best known for his essays. John Updike has called Hoagland, quote, the best essayist of my generation, unquote. Hoagland's collections include The Courage of Turtles, Red Wolves and Black Bears, and Heart's Desire. Our book critic John Leonard is also a Hoagland fan. He has a review of Hoagland's new collection, Balancing Acts.
Wherever he goes, Ted Hoagland always seems to find a woman and an epiphany. He may in these splendid essays be going blind from cataracts, and his novels don't sell. And his Eastern Establishment Wall Street father cut him out of his will. And the Lesbian Gay Bisexual Alliance on the Bennington College campus is after his teaching job because of something he said in Esquire magazine about AIDS and anal sex. But as Hoagland ran away in his boyhood to join the circus, he will run away at 50-something to Wyoming or British Honduras, to Okefenokee or North Yemen, to Alaska or the library. His heroes in the library are Joseph Conrad and Henry David Thoreau and John Muir, the last Emersonian and the first Sierra Clubby, the grandfather Whitebeard, naturalist and rhapsodist, who discovered in the migrations of ice and the movements of bears, in volcanoes and landslides and glaciers and oceans of flowers and the jubilee of waters, the miraculous character and the healing divinity of life here and now. What Hoagland's running away from, among other things, is New York literary life, all the little greedheads wheeling around the tricycles of their careers. To such cocktail party contract chit-chat, he prefers a train, a horse, a sleeping bag with someone warm in it, and difficulties. This doesn't mean he hasn't opinions, and strong ones, on writers like Updike and Bellow, Grace Paley and Philip Roth, Turgenev, Melville, and Faulkner. But he also has opinions, in Fort Yukon, about a $2 cup of moose stew, and in Nicaragua, about grackles and pelicans and almond trees, or in North Africa, about the mud skyscrapers and the steam baths heated by human dung, and the blindfolded camels turning underground grindstones, and 100 mosques in the spring rain, and the residue of an astral religion in a moon temple compound from the time of Sheba. What isn't lost, he asks? Children, money, time, love? He looks for them anyway, having confided to his journal, "When you come to the end of your life, make sure you're used up." And wherever, information of the oddest sort seems to find him. Turgenev's brain, we are told, was the heaviest ever recorded, 4.7 pounds when 3 is average. Or, "You butter a cat's paws when moving it to a new home so it can find its way back after going out exploring the first time." And so will Hoagland, with butter on his paws, find his way back. From nature to art, he explains, from west to east. In North America, we go west with such hope and zest because we anticipate that nature will reinvigorate art and intelligence and patch up their inadequacies and failings. But we come east again, lonely for art, lonely in nature. What he comes back with is another wonderful book. The big divide in writers, he says, seems to be between the free spirits who sit down every morning to speak their minds without first calculating the market for it, and staff writers in what I call mule trains, well-fed, nicely harnessed, with bits in their mouths and bottoms upraised for the whip of an editor, who write cover stories for Time or dance attendance upon the mindset of Vanity Fair on retainer. Well, yes, but there's a bigger divide between literature and typing, and Ted Hoagland's on the heroic other side of it, joyful in a jubilee of waters.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Edward Hoagland's new collection of essays, Balancing Acts. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jonita Cole, the first woman president of Spelman College, the Georgia-based college for African-American women. Cole is the head of the Clinton Transition Team's education group. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.